Well, hello, this is Jeff Gattiosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. And if all you know of my next guest are a few big hits from the 80s, then you're missing out on a great 40-plus year career that spans 16 studio records, 7 novels in his own historical, horror, rock and roll, mystery genre, and a morning radio show. And on top of all of it, he is a master of the pun. Can you believe I have him on this place, Straws? So they did that. Anyway, please welcome Greg Kim.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And before we get started, and this will probably be online in a couple of days, but so everyone knows that on the day we're sitting here talking, I am honored to be celebrating Greg's 70th birthday with him.
I can't believe it. You know, here's the amazing part. Of the original band, you know, the original Greg Kim band, there's only two guys left. It's me and drummer Larry Lynch, who I just rehearsed with. Everybody else is gone. You know, Gary Phillips, cancer. Dave Carpenter, heart attack. Steve Wright, stroke. You know, there was so, and now I look around and it's just a couple of us left. You know, my son's been playing lead guitar in the band, you know, for about the last 10 years. But, you know, other than that, I feel like I want to hang on to my heritage because, you know, we were rehearsing with Larry today and he's got a certain touch when he plays songs like Remember, or a breakup song, he's got a certain touch, and it really drives the band. It's a completely different energy. So, you know, even though I am kind of in, you know, this has been a great career, and I've been blessed, and, you know, I've had a great run. But, you know, looking back on it right now, I really feel like we got a legacy, and it's time for us to cement it. We're playing a lot of gigs like with Rick Springfield. And a lot of we get a lot of the same demographics, you know, audience wise, but now they're bringing their sons and daughters because their sons and daughters are like 20. And it's like the second generation of fans. And it's pretty cool, man.
Well, you know, certain music is timeless. I think you're one of those artists where you listen to a song today and it sounds just as great as it did when it came out 30 years ago.
You know, it's amazing that you were bringing that up because I was just talking to Larry about that, not about an hour ago. We were talking about, you know, a lot of the gigs we played. And one of the guys that came up was Steve Miller. And he says, you know, Steve Miller never gets old. I mean, he sounds as good today as he always did. And he made a million. And I thought to myself, well, you know, we've played many, many shows with Steve Miller. And, you know, there is a similarity there. But I love, you know, I love my generation of bands. You know, we were playing with Huey Lewis in the News, and we're playing with Rick Springfield, and, you know, my old buddies, Eddie Money and Tommy Two-Tone and people like that. So, you know, we're keeping busy. And, you know, I think as long as I make albums, I'm working on the next one right now, as long as we keep coming up with new songs and we go into the studio and record them, I mean, this thing is going to keep going.
Yeah, and it's funny, you mentioned a lot of your peers like that. One guy that, you know, I always kind of think of your music as really similar at that I think would be a great tour is you and Willie Nile. Yeah, I mean,
we did a couple of tours way back in the 80s with Willie Nile, and just, I had a great time. I respect Willie. He's a great songwriter. He puts on a really good show. And it was a real nice 1-2 punch with Willie. But, you know, I've always had a good relationship with the Jersey bands, like Bruce and Southside Johnny and, you know, guys like that, John McCafferty. We played a lot of gigs over the years, and you know, it's just been I've been blessed. I keep coming back to that thing, but I really feel like, you know, this could have turned out horrible, and it turned out great.
Yeah, I mean, not many people have a career that lasts this long, so that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, you know, it's all part of the creative muscle in your brain, you know, and whether and my wife makes fun of me, everybody makes fun of me because I'm always working on something.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? If I'm not chewing on something right now, I'm not a happy guy. So, like, I'm at any given time, I'm working on two or three songs, which I am right now, probably, and I'm about halfway through the next novel, so that's in it. As long as I get that creative juice going, when that dries up, maybe I'll hang it up.
Well, hopefully that's not for quite a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talked about the original guys in the Gray Kin Band. I mean, you guys released that debut back in 76. You know, what was the reaction like when you put out those first few records? Because it took, you know, until your sixth record, Rock and Roll,
yeah,
breakup song, to really break big.
Isn't that amazing? Because you could never do that in today's world.
No, there's no way you get six records. You know,
Well, you know what? Berserkly was kind of a singular company. They didn't play by the books. And basically, the best thing about Berserkly, you know, as far as my band is concerned, they just left us alone. Mm-hmm. You know, I would rehearse the band. It was basic, really easy arrangements. And we would rehearse, and then we'd go in the studio, and we'd cut it like we rehearsed it. So it was also, I got to tell you, we were the first album, we did the entire album, including the cover shot, everything, for $10,000.
Oh, my God.
And I remember I was over at Eddie Money's house, and he had just done his first album. We were buddies in the old days. And Ed's manager, a guy named Victor Rocky at the time, he says, Ed, he hands my first album to Eddie, and he says, Ed, you should do something like this. This only costs $10,000. And Eddie looks at it and he says, for what, the cover? He had just spent $100,000 on his first album. So that was it. We were kind of a low-budget group there early in the mm-hmm. But, you know, the nice thing was we didn't need big budgets. You know, we were really a live band, and we wrote songs, we rehearsed them, and very much in the – actually, we recorded a lot of those albums in the house that Creedence built, which was Studio C at Fantasy Studios right here in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only studio you could get in. You didn't have to go through the front end. You could go into the side door.
Yeah, but I think with a company like Berserkly, too, it gave you guys the ability to evolve as a live band without, you know, that big record company breathing down your neck. And I think that showed in the evolution of the records. You guys were
because we were encouraged to write songs and they left us alone, and we really didn't realize, and this is the beauty of when you're a baby band and you're just starting out. We didn't realize that it was impossible. We just thought, hey, some guy's going to pay for us to go in the studio. Let's go. You know, we never thought that it, you know, like you guys are never going to make it. You know, we didn't care. We, at the time, which was late 70s, early 80s, there were FM stations all around the country,
mm-hmm.
and they all of them played album tracks. You didn't have to really put out a single. And, you know, like For You, which was on the second album, and Madison Avenue is another one. A lot of those early songs were turntable hits, and they got a lot of airplay on FM stations. So then we could go and play local clubs, and we did. We did that for many, many years. You know, we would play Bogarts in Cincinnati, and I remember the Agora was in Cleveland, and there was a play at the Paradise in Boston, Stone Pony in Asbury Park. Yeah, so we went around and played all these places, and we could pack them out because we were getting airplay. So even though we didn't have hit records yet, people knew our songs. And the other thing was I did a lot of radio. I was one of the few guys that enjoyed getting up early and doing morning radio shows. So if we were playing in, say, Cincinnati, I'd get up, take a cab down to the station, and hang out with them in the morning of the gig, you know, which is unheard of.
Right.
You know, I'd bring the acoustic guitar, do a couple of tunes, you know, a couple, you know, funny stories about the road, and that was it. And that would pack the place, you know, that those, and if you did it, let me put it this way, if you went to a town and you didn't do that, the place would only be half full.
Right.
If you went to town and you did do that, there it was always a great turnout. And, of course, we were the, you know, in the early days, we were kind of like the, you know, the critics' darlings. You know, we could do no wrong, and everybody, you know, liked what we were doing. You know, it was like the Springsteen thing. You know, everything that we ever did as a band, we just did it. We didn't think about why we were doing it or how it was going to affect our career. For instance, I was listening to Asbury. I remember seeing Bruce. I've known Bruce for many, many moons. And I remember seeing Bruce do a guest set at the Troubadour when he was working on the first album, Asbury Park, Greetings from Asbury Park. And I saw him, and it was just him and an acoustic guitar.
Right.
And he was phenomenal. And I said, man, this guy's one of the great songwriters of all time. So I got that first album, and I started playing a version of For You, which I thought was a brilliant song. And lo and behold, the Berserkly heard it, and they said, you know, let's cut it. So we did it. We did it in a studio. I remember we did it in like two or three takes. It was really fresh. And then Bruce heard my version. He started doing my version live, which was blew my mind because, you know, I basically, when people ask me, what's your version? And I said, well, it was a Byrds approach, you know, just like the Byrds did Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn, Turn. I had a jangly 12-string Rickenbacker guitar. And, you know, the guys were pretty straightforward 4/4 rock. And it came off great. So then that sparked, about a year later, Bruce would start showing up at gigs, and he showed up. We were playing at the Roxy in L.A. And here comes Bruce, and he's hanging backstage with us, and he loved my version of For You, and he said, I want to give you another song, and it was Rendezvous.
Yeah.
So he gives me the Rendezvous. He writes the lyrics on a napkin from the Roxy. I stick it in my pocket. Now, in those days, we had to do two sets. We'd do an early show and then a late show, and I sweated like a pig. Well, I go out there, and when I got back to the hotel, I reach in my pocket to look at the lyrics, and it's white pulp. So I was freaking out, and I go, oh, my God, Springsteen gave me a song, and now I can't do it because I don't have to.
But it's through it.
Yeah, so I called John Landau's office, and I said, you know, I explained, you know, Bruce gave me the song, and he says, okay, no problem, I'm going to send you a cassette. So he sends me a cassette, which I must have listened to a million times, and I think it was an outtake from the Born to Run sessions, you know, because they had that same sound.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Bruce is not really known for his diction. You know, and there were some lyrics that I could not figure out that he was singing. Like in the bridge, it totally sounds to me like he's singing, we desire so much more than squirrels. And, you know, I'm thinking, I can't be right.
You're
that's
not.
And I played that cassette maybe 1,000 times for everybody that I knew. The guys in the band, they go, oh, yeah, it's squirrels.
It got to be squirrels.
So I kind of slurred my voice when I did it. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, we desire so much more. You know, I didn't really sing it either way, but I knew it wasn't squirrels. So a year later, Springsteen shows up at a gig and he goes, hey, Greg, there ain't no squirrels in that song, man. And I really felt, you know, I was thinking, okay, well, that's it. There were no squirrels. I suspected that.
Yeah.
And you know what the real lyrics were?
What?
It was, we desire so much more than this girl. But
yeah,
he kind of slurred it, and then this girl didn't really come out
together.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, hey, I was thrilled to do it. And I, you know, looking back, every time I see Springsteen, it's like, you know, it's a laugh. You know, there's one thing. I'm going to give you a little tip, okay?
Definitely.
When you're with other, you know, with a big rock star like Bruce Springsteen or whoever, right? The best thing to do is get in, you know, if you're visiting backstage, and this is one thing that Springsteen actually told me. He says, I think it's really cool. I breeze in. Hey, you know, I hug Bruce. We do a shot of tequila. We talk for 5 minutes, and then I leave. I leave. Nobody else leaves. They all come in and they wait. They wait until he's no longer in the room, then they leave.
Everyone
if he goes into
long.
Room B, they all get into room B. You know, but for me, I was like, hey, how you doing? Great to see you. Sounded good. See you later. And, you know, we do a shot of tequila, which is traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce let me in knowing that I would be in there for 5 minutes, say my thing, and leave. And that, you know, and that endeared me to the whole band, because the last thing they wanted to do was talk for a half an hour.
Right.
You know,
3 hour show.
Yeah. So, you know, plus they're all drunk, wrung out. I mean, at the end of a Springsteen show, and that guy is sweats, his clothes are sweated through.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's one of the hardest working men in showbiz. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I said before, it was all kind of by accident. You know, we did the first song because we loved it. The second one he gave me, you know, and then we had the story about the lyrics. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I look back on those days and I realized I didn't know what I didn't know. That was the key. I didn't know what I didn't know. And I didn't know a lot. But I didn't know what I didn't know.
Right. So you do it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just same thing. You know, I do a lot of writers' groups and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And I talk to other writers, and I say, look, first of all, if you're a writer, just write. Write it even if it sucks. In fact, get those bad ones out of you now. Get that, exercise that thing. Write it even if it sucks, because you get better every time. And, you know, writing is a craft, just like playing a guitar, something like that. And you start recognizing what is good about a story and what's bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's like I learned how to do my editing from a lady named Natalia Aponte, who was my editor at the first, my first publisher was Tor Books, T-O-R. And, you know, she schooled me, you know, and we, you know, she was a tough editor. So I would send like a chapter and it would come back all redlined. And she always said, remember, when you're writing a novel, scenes of action and dialogue knitted together with, transitional phrases, but scenes of action and dialogue. So, you know, when you're writing the book, you kind of pre-edit it. You know what I mean? Rather than do a lot of explaining, you give some dialogue to a couple of characters and you let them talk it out, and that's a much better way of approaching writing a novel.
Now, what led you to do that first novel in 96? You know, you were still making music. Did you just have it kind of pent up in you where you're like, I got this idea and I just need to get it out, you know, and then you've done
it. Yeah, that's
what
it was. What
made you do that first?
I wanted to, first of all, I'd always been a writer of sorts, you know, going back to junior high school. I used to write short stories and little plays and, you know, they were all crazy sci-fi and horror kind of stuff. But, you know, I was coming up with ideas. And the whole thing was, I remember writing stories in high school and junior high school. And by the time I was doing the first novel, I was just writing it, just from sheer joy of writing. And it started as a short story, which really became the first chapter of the novel. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was a short story, and I enjoyed it so much, I just kept going. And 500 pages later, he was like, oh, my God, what did I just do?
It's, and then, you know, the rest kind of grew out of there. Because all the novels are somewhat related, you know, in terms of story and character.
Yes. And, yes, they are.
And they all, in the later ones especially, involve historical, real people, the Beatles, the Stones. I mean, do you ever get a chance to talk to those people and kind of get their views on what you wrote?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing the morning radio show at KFOX was in San Francisco. It's a major market. So I would, you know, everybody that came through town would wind up on the show. You know, guys like Ozzy Osbourne or whoever. And I got to interview the Beatles or the surviving Beatles. Paul McCartney was on the road. He was playing locally. And somehow I got a radio interview through KFOX. And so I got to interview Paul. Actually, I interviewed him twice because he came back a couple months later.
Yeah.
And in the interview, and I also got to interview Ringo. Now, John was obviously gone and George was gone at that point. But at least I got to talk to the two surviving members of the Beatles. And I asked them both the same question. Where did the Beatles get their music? Because they didn't have any import shops. You couldn't go down to, you know, Brian Epstein's store and buy the latest Chuck Berry's.
Right.
You'd have to order it. So where did they get? And also they were playing four or five sets a night. And they needed material because they'd have to, you know, repeat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed a repertoire. So they both, Ringo and Paul, gave me the same answer. He said, we got the stuff from Merchant Marines, guys that we had gone to school with, and then they would, be, you know, join the Merchant Marines, and they would go back and forth between New York, Baltimore, and Liverpool. And, it, you know, every two or three weeks they'd show up in Liverpool and they would bring back those 45s. You know, 45s were everything back in the old days.
Right. Yeah,
and
did.
So, you know, here, so, you know, when I asked them, you know, where did you hear Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers? Oh, Merchant Marine lent us that record. And he said that for a lot of stuff. So it gave me the idea of a character who's got a secondhand store, and his name is Dustbin Bob because he gets most of his stuff out of the dustbin, which is garbage can for Anglophiles. So I thought to myself, man, this guy could be the best friend of the Beatles, furnish the music that the Beatles would make famous, and all those covers on the first couple of albums. Where did they get that stuff? Well, they got it from Dustbin Bob. So I invented this guy, And then Dustin Bob started having adventures. Lo and behold, he saves the Beatles' lives from an assassination attempt by Marcos royalists in the Philippines. And I talked to Ringo, and he said, you know, the Philippines was the scariest, most horrible thing we'd ever done. We'd been around the world, but, and he said they pulled their security. They had a feud going with the Marcos regime, and they couldn't get room service. They couldn't leave the hotel. They pulled all their bodyguards. And then Brian Epstein, who was with them on that trip, gets this rumor that the Beatles will be assassinated when they get to the airport leaving. Because all the assassinations in the Philippines always took place in the airport.
Yeah, the airport,
and
yeah.
Back in those days, mm-hmm. There were no jetways. You had to walk across the tarmac to get to the plane.
Yeah,
and that's where they got everybody. You know, that's where they assassinated a bunch of politicians that way. But that's how they were going to get the Beatles. And Dustin Bob, you know, gets wind of it and saves the Beatles. And there's when I talked to Ringo, he said when we got close to the plane, Brian Epstein, who was right in front of him, goes, "Run, boys, run for the plane. Don't walk, run." And they all ran like, you know, crazy people. It was such a powerful story when they told it to me that it became the basis of the book, you know.
Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely encourage everyone to, you know, not only check out your music, but check out those books. They're fun reads, they're great reads, and again, bringing in those historical elements, but adding a twist to them is always, it's really cool.
Thank you. I that's one of my favorite things to do. It's almost as good as writing songs.
Definitely. I can see how it melds together. You know,
I was just messing around. When I got to the rehearsal, they already had the drums set up, mm-hmm. and Rye was just messing around on the guitar, and Larry started playing, and I started writing a song called "I'm Going to Kiss You in the Parking Lot." I'm going to kiss you in the parking lot. And it was like they started playing it, and before I know, we were like halfway written the song. And it was like, hey, wait, we got to rehearse. We, you know, put this one on the back burner.
And we just mentioned Rye is your son. And then also you have Robert Barry on bass. Correct?
Robert Barry, man, is there better musician?
I did an interview with him when the 3.2 record came out. He's a great guy.
Oh, yeah. He's one of the finest musicians mm-hmm. I've ever known. Plays every mm-hmm. instrument in the band.
Yeah.
He's a great drummer. He's a great guitar player. He's a great bass player. He's a killer keyboard player.
And
he's a great songwriter. I love working with him. You know, I go down. He's got Soundtech Studios, which is his studio down in Campbell, which is about 45-minute drive from here. But I go down usually every Wednesday, and we just kick around song ideas. And you know, it's like one of the best things. And he's a great guy to bounce ideas off of because he has the same, you know, the same roots that I have, you know, British invasion and stuff like that.
And, you know, we've talked a lot about your band, you know, the guys in the original band, the guys now. But one era that I want to bring up, because I don't think a lot of people realize it, is on your Love and Rock and Roll record back in 86, you tapped this unknown guitar player from San Francisco to be on it, who turns out to be Joe Satriani. How did you find Joe Satriani?
Well, Joe was legendary. He was a Berkeley boy, and he had a band called The Squares, and they would open for us around, you know, the clubs. You know, we were playing like the Long Branch and the Keystone, a lot of clubs back in the day,
mm-hmm.
and they would open a lot of those shows. And of course, everybody you know, recognized that Joe was a genius. I mean, he was just so good. And I had asked him earlier when Dave Carpenter left and Grant Douglas came along, in between those guys, I had asked Joe to join the band. I said, Joe, you know, you'll make more money, you'll be happy. And he goes, yeah, I'd love to, but I'm loyal to my guys. And until this band breaks up, I can't do it. So lo and behold, about a year later, the Squares break up, and I get a call from Joe, okay, I'll do it. And I was like, all right. This is the guy I've been trying to get in the band for years. The problem was Joe is too good. He's way too good. He's too good for my band. You know, my band, we're very real meat and potatoes, real basic three-chord rock.
Yeah.
We're probably closer to Creedence Clearwater than we are to Cream. And, you know, and Joe needed a much bigger palette, you know. And I remember telling him, I said, Joe, I only got three chords in these songs. You're a 3 million chords to express yourself. And talk about a really super-duper dedicated musician. He would get there to the sound check. You know, the whole band would show up. We'd sound check for like 20 minutes and leave and go back to the hotel, right? You know, we had to go back and smoke pot and drink beer and, you know, do all that band stuff. Well, good old Joe Satriani stayed at the gig, and he continued sound checking his guitar right up until 5 minutes before the show. He was meticulous, and he would do scales, you know, just to get his things, his fingers limbered, and he was just unbelievable. And eventually, I said, you know, look, Joe, it's you're too good for my band. And by the way, I've heard your solo stuff because he was playing it for me when he was working on these song ideas. And I said, look, I've heard your stuff. It's brilliant. You absolutely positively have to go solo and do this, because if you don't do it, you're going against nature. And he said, okay, I believe he was replaced by Jimmy Lyon. Jimmy Lyon was a great guitar player, played with Eddie Money for many years and played with Tina Turner. And, you know, he's been around the block. And then it was my son, Rye. When Jimmy left the band, Rye, and by this time, Rye had been watching Joe Satriani, and he took lessons from Joe.
Oh, really?
He was, you know, back in the early days when Joe was not a superstar yet, he had, you know, he offered lessons. Of course, you had to be great or he wouldn't do it. And he had a list of guys like Kurt Hammett from Metallica, Steve Vai. All these guys came here, made the pilgrimage to sit at Joe's feet and learn stuff. And Rye was his teacher. Well, I couldn't, that was hard to say. And, you know, he just stepped right in, and a lot of the stuff that Rye plays, I think, is inspired by Joe. And if you listen to the new album on stuff like Pink Flamingos and The Life I Got and stuff like that, it's new. It's kind of like a step beyond where Joe was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, well, Joe.
I'm glad you brought up the last record, Rekindled, because I think it's just an amazing record. It's one of those that may have flown under the radar a bit, but again, check it out.
Yeah. It really is the great lost Greg Kinn album, and I'll tell you,
I love it. I love it.
I get more compliments on that when I go around the country. We play three or four songs out of that new album during the show. Obviously, when I play a live show, I got to do Break Up and Jeopardy and all that kind of stuff. But we always do three or four off the new album, and they go down great. like Pink Flamingos is a great live song. And people, like, they actually sing along and they don't even know it yet. And a lot of the people hearing it for the first time, it's like, wow, I didn't know Greg Kinn could do that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's another phase. We're going to continue to milk this cow. We're going to pull up a stool and milk this Guernsey for as long as possible until I run out of ideas.
Well, you know, the world needs more rock and roll, and it's, you know, guys like you that are going to be bringing it. And I mean, are you thinking you're working on a new record now?
Yeah, we've already got two
mm-hmm.
tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, into it, yeah, and we're all of it is different, you know. And if you would say, what does it sound like? Well, it sounds like the next step after the last album. That's what
right.
it sounds like. Mm-hmm. It's a little more progressive. There's a little more, you know, virtuoso flashing of the guitars,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, you know, I'm a real three chord guy. So most of the songs are very, very basic, very organic.
Mm-hmm. And you also are got another book in the pipeline as well.
Oh yeah. And this one's a pip. I really love it. I got two coming down the pike right at the same simultaneously. And one of them is called Southern Gothic, and it's about the devil and Hank Williams.
Oh, that's going to be
really
awesome.
It's going to be a cool
mm-hmm.
thing. Yeah, I'm about three quarters of the way through
mm-hmm.
that. And then I got another one about the mafia in the record business. It's called 45 RPM that I think the fans of Dustbin Bob will like mm-hmm. because it's much more, you know, musically oriented.
You sure that one's fiction? Because there's probably enough real stories about that.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I just listen to, you know, I get a lot of this, and I hang out with other musicians, and I'm always hearing stories, you know. One of the guys is a good friend of mine, Kenny Laguna.
From Joan Jett?
He's Joan mm-hmm. Jett's manager and producer. And he's been with Joni for a million
mm-hmm.
years. And I love them both. They're really good friends of mm-hmm. mine. But he was in the original Shondells.
Oh, I never knew
Tommy
that.
James and
mm-hmm.
the Shondells.
Yep.
Yeah, so we're going down the highway in a rented car. And Crimson and Clover, he goes, oh, hey, I sang on that. Another song called, oh yeah, I'm on Moni Moni, that's me on the keyboard there. And so I, you know, they were on Roulette Records, which was the infamous godfather of the music business,
mm-hmm.
Morris Levy. He was like, you know, he was a made guy, right? And I get all of these stories about, you know, how they would go to the office to get money, and you know, he'd flash a gun on them and, you know, threaten their lives, and he'd hang guys out the window by their socks, and you know, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, well, that's what it was like back in the 60s, early 70s. There was a lot of mob rule in the music
yeah.
business.
Yeah.
You know, the mob controlled coin op stuff, things that you could put a quarter in,
mm-hmm.
like jukeboxes, and they had thousands of jukeboxes, and if they wanted you to have a number one record, like let's say Tommy James and the Shondells, they'd put one in every jukebox in the land, and you'd have an instant million seller,
yeah.
and you'd be number one. And they used to control it. You know, nowadays in the new Wild West, anything goes. I don't think that those kind of shyster guys are still around, or if they are, I don't hear about it.
You can't, because with the internet, anybody could put anything up on their own site, and you know, someone will find it and stream it, and it's a hit. You know, there's no rules anymore. You know.
Yeah.
Now I know you have a few shows coming up with the Rick Springfield tour on the West Coast. Anything else planned for the fall? Will we ever get you out here on the East Coast?
Yeah, I'm planning to be there probably around the end of the summer. Let's see, we're going to go out in the Midwest next, and we'll be playing like Minot, South Dakota, and places like that, and Edmonton, Canada, and places like that. Mm-hmm. And then I would imagine by, say, October, November, we'll be on the East Coast, and I'm really looking forward to playing back there because, as you say, we rarely go out on the road
it's
a lot of fun.
You know, I'm based out here in Connecticut, so hopefully we can catch in Connecticut and New York or Mass, and would love to come by and see the show. And, you know, Greg, again, just thank you so much for taking the time today. I wish you the happiest of birthdays and many more to come. I know there's a lot of great music and a lot of great writing still to come from you, so looking forward to it.
Thanks a ton, man. I really appreciate it. And thanks thanks for a good interview. Sometimes it's like pulling teeth, and sometimes it's a pleasant discussion.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right, Jeff. Talk to you later.
You got it. Bye, my friend.
Bye-bye. Bye.